Hello and at long last, welcome back to the TLDR News Podcast. I'm Jack Kelly and I'm joined by Zach, TLDR's Editor-in-Chief.
Hello.
Nadia, one of TLDR's newest journalists.
Hello.
And Georgina, a kind of ditto, also a new journalist.
Hello.
How are you both doing?
Really good, thank you.
Inaugural podcast experience.
Yeah.
The audience might be familiar with you from main videos. You've hosted a few videos, appeared on the Daily Briefing, but this is the first time in this ludicrous league table format that we have. So welcome to the panel.
You should probably explain to the audience the league table. We're doing a league table thing. Okay, fine, whatever.
We've obviously taken a little bit of a break from the podcast since we last did it. That was primarily because Zach was away as our editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
His wife was having a baby, which went well. Baby is here.
Yeah, I mean, it went well as labour can go. But sure. It was, baby is here. Baby is great.
Any updates on baby?
Baby was actually...
Why do we keep saying baby?
She's called Margot. She was a pest last night, but she is otherwise pretty brilliant.
Oh.
Pretty flawless, actually.
Great. Where's she going on the league table?
Yeah, we were genuinely going to put on the league table. I think it would be quite good fun. But for now, we're going to stick with real politicians.
Okay, cool.
I also didn't want it to be like, recorded for posterity and her sort of main memory of my fatherhood. It's just me like moving her down, being like, you were a pest last night. Or anything like that.
That is fair. Coming up in today's episode, then, we're going to run through a number of underreported stories that our team has selected from the last few weeks since we last recorded the podcast. And then instead of going into a main story and discussing that, we're going to jump straight to the World Leader Leaderboard, which is where we rank all of the different politicians around the world and how they performed recently. And we're jumping straight to that part of the podcast because there's a lot to catch up on. It's been a while since we last did this. We've got some new faces who will want to contribute new faces to the board. And it makes sense to just jump into the changes that we can get the board sorted. Let's run through your underreported stories of the... I normally say week, but couple months.
Yeah, good point.
And Zach, let's start with your one.
Oh, this is such an archetypally Zach story to come back to, but it's about oil prices.
Oh no.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I'll do it very, very quickly.
No, not this time. It's totally made up. Pure fiction.
It's just that oil prices have started rising. So Brent crude is currently trading at like between $85 and $90 a barrel. That's like, I don't know, 15% above what it was a month ago. And in the upper end of the sort of like normal range, it's actually even higher than the sort of nominal number suggests because the dollar is still quite strong at the moment. So if you're a country like, let's say, Pakistan or India and you import all your oil, you have to convert all your currency into dollars, which is more expensive than usual. And then you have to pay that extra high price for the oil. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting for a couple of reasons. I mean, the obvious one, I think before we get into it, the first one, you had like, why has oil prices really gone up? I think there are broadly like a couple of reasons. I mean, one, Ukraine targeting Russian oil refineries, that has had an impact on the global price. There is also good coordination amongst OPEC Plus. They're limiting the amount of supply. But the main reason is just like the escalating war in Gaza and just sort of renewed anxieties about that spilling out into the wider Middle East and how that will affect global oil supplies. I do think it's super important because I think that like people underestimate. So if you're in the West, Western economies are looking pretty fragile at the moment, maybe with the exception of the US, especially like in Europe. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen how disruptive high energy prices can be to Europe. I don't really think Europe has the sort of like economic bandwidth, economic like slack in the system to deal with another even mild energy shock, especially because high energy prices usually mean high inflation and that will in turn mean higher interest rates. It's such a mean story, but I'm just going to go through it very quickly. And I also think if you're in America, America's currently the world's biggest oil exporter, which very few people know because basically OPEC Plus is reducing supply. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Russia are both reducing supply, but also because for the last 10 years or so, 15 years, America's enjoyed a boom in its hydrocarbon industry thanks to shale, basically fracking. But one of the difficult things here is that even though America exports lots of oil, when oil prices go up, inflation goes up in America because it's still consuming quite a lot of oil. And that means high interest rates, and high interest rates in turn make it very difficult for the shale industry to survive because it relies a lot on cheap credit. So the relationship to oil prices in the American economy is like really convoluted and just quite precarious.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that oil prices are great for basically the West's nemesis. So oil prices are great for Russia. Russia has already, basically in its latest budget figures, said that its revenues are way stronger than expected. That's partly because the discount between what Russian oil sells at and what the rest of the world sells oil at is closing. They found ways around the sanctions, but it's also because oil prices are high.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that Putin can continue to prosecute his war against Ukraine as he sees fit. And it's also great news for someone like Iran, which has obviously become like a renewed geopolitical player of interest, given the tensions in the Middle East. And the last thing worth saying, the sort of like, I don't know, if you're like an American policymaker, the silver lining here is that it has probably pretty detrimental effect on China, which is struggling economically and obviously has a massive manufacturing base. So high energy prices, China's a massive energy importer. High energy prices obviously make manufacturing more expensive and more difficult. And that would be terrible news for China's economy, given that it's already sort of teetering on the brink. So I just think that like we're not really prepared for the significant impacts that like structurally high oil prices could have on the global economy.
Huge impact.
Huge. Could be huge. Yeah. So that's it.
Amazing. Georgina, what is your underreported story? It doesn't have to be as long as that.
Sorry.
Okay. My underreported story is also very on brand, as Zach would say, in a different way. Less about oil, more about ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. But it's about how the proportion of casualties from the war in, from Putin's war in Ukraine are far higher among Russia's ethnic minorities compared to their share of the population.
Okay.
And it's kind of a few months old, this story, but it's not really made headlines anywhere in the Western news. And it's not, I guess, part of the reason is because regions like Buryatia, which is in the southeastern part of Siberia, other parts of Siberia where there's been huge recruitment drives or where more the proportion of casualties has been much higher compared to the share of population. Mm-hmm. It's partly because those regions are a lot poorer and less economically developed. And there's not a lot of other jobs for young men to do other than become soldiers. But yeah, I think it's really interesting when you compare the statistics that like Buryats, who are a Mongolic ethnic group, are make up like 0.31% of the population, but 1.16% of deaths. So they have almost four times as many shares of war casualties compared to the population, the rest of the population. And the same is true of like the Tuvans, who are another ethnic minority in Russia, and the Kalmyks as well.
Very interesting. Good perspective. I like it. Thank you so much.
I think that's a really good story, but I don't know if you saw there was the those protests in like Bashkortostan a couple of months ago. I don't know if that was related to that, but there was also some upset when they first announced the partial like mobilization in those regions because they were apparently being targeted more heavily.
Yeah. I think there is something to be said as well for the fact that like the average Russian, politically active Russian voter or citizen will probably feel slightly less kind of connected to maybe some of those parts of the country or you know, seeing casualties from groups that they can't relate to as much as kind of does offer Putin a bit of political protection in a way. But yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I also wanted to do like a video on Russian separatism. Not separatism.
You're calling me out now because I should.
I'm trying to get the audience to petition
just
for
like,
it.
Because, you know, there's so many like, you know, ethnic minorities and like you said, like, you know, it does offer like Putin some kind of like protection, but like, I want to do a video for Zach how these like these like ethnic minorities or like separatist movements could eventually be.
Has this become a form Putin's for calling downfall? Out my questionable editorial decisions? Yeah.
I think it sounds pretty interesting.
Thank you.
It'll make a good thumbnail, smashing up Russia.
I actually do regret not signing up on that video. Not least,
you know, from the inside, you know.
Which I get it. I do regret not signing off on that. I mean, now we're just talking about the real ins and outs of the business, but because James Kerr Lindsay, I don't know if you know who that bloke is, he does a lot of similar content to us, but he did a really great video on I hope I'm saying
I don't it. I recommend think, someone else's video before about
it's really
to make
good
this
should,
video.
It was very very successful, so apologies. I feel like I'm editorializing to other employees. I'm sorry for not signing off on that video. But okay.
If you want it, comment below.
I also think actually a very timely unreported story, given the like tensions between Russian nationalists in places like Moscow and like ethnic minorities, especially obviously Tajiks, in Russia post the Crocus Hall attacks. The Russian nationalists have long been calling for basically like tighter restrictions on Central Asian immigration into Russia, and that has really like strained relations between just like lots of ethnic Russians and like its ethnic minorities, but also between Russian nationalists and the Kremlin, who are, you know, Russian nationalists are especially annoyed now.
I was going to bring that point into it at some point if there was a bit of this back and forth, which there seems to be now. But yeah, to say as well that it's interesting in light of that Crocus Hall attack that, like, prior to that, or maybe still, I'm not sure, but Putin was also trying to increase recruitment drives of Central Asian migrants or asylum seekers, or, you know, people in Russia who had, well, that's what a migrant is, come from Central Asian countries. But so no, now no.
Now we're doing this whole podcast thing where there's a back and forth, i.e. a discussion. There's, I think that actually this relates quite nicely to my story, because one of the this is what a discussion. But the one of the issues that Putin was previously having before oil prices went up was that if you're sending, you're basically sending off lots of your ethnic minorities to fight in Ukraine, you need more migration to basically fill your labor market, especially if you're like plowing loads of money into the system to build loads of military equipment. And there was tentative evidence that the labor market was pretty tight. So basically there weren't enough workers, and that was pushing up inflation, pushing up wages and then prices. And high oil prices get them out of that, because obviously if you have high oil prices, you can just use that like foreign currency to just buy stuff from abroad rather than like run your labor market really hot to produce it at home.
Come back to oil.
Always comes back to oil. Nadia, is yours equally on brand?
It's a Balkan story.
Nice.
But I'm not going to go too much into it. I'm prepared maybe as many notes. It's just the fact that, and also it is a video that I wanted to get Zach to sign up. But it's basically to Bulgaria. Bulgaria. Obviously, an EU country, it's going into its six general elections in the span of 3 years. So, the parliament.
It's a very effective lobbying technique, by the way. It's to out me in public.
No. There wasn't.
That's okay.
I think it's really interesting. Like, there's in 2020, there were these massive like protests against all these kind of like corruption scandals that were completely engulfed the government. And, six general elections in 3 years, that's, you know, I can't.
It's a lot of elections.
That's a lot of elections. I can't think of any other country that's gone through that. And it's kind of this battle between these kind of Russophiles and Russophobes in Bulgaria. And I think it's really interesting. And I think the outcome, if the outcome is, you know, more kind of anti-West parties in parliament, then, you know, we just had the Slovak election with Vitos Pellegrini coming in. That's just, you know, it will just be another extra EU country that is a lot more, not, I don't want to say like just pro-Russia, it's too simple, but a lot more.
Like Ukraine skeptic.
Yeah, Ukraine skeptic, which, you know, big thing since the war's still going to be probably going on for quite a while. So that's my story.
Didn't they win one of the elections?
Yeah.
And then they lost again?
Yeah.
Okay.
They just kind of come to like a consensus.
Got it. Well, yeah, another Bulgarian election to pay attention to. Sounds like another great video, Nadia. I appreciate first time on the podcast, and it's a new technique, and I really appreciate just the new strategy of podcast appearances.
I'm feeling the strain.
I'm not surprised. You should. Okay, those are the underreported stories this week. If you have your own suggestions of stories you think are underreported, feel free to let us know in the comments, and you might see it show up next week. But now, let's move on to the World Leader Leaderboard. Okay, so if you haven't seen the show before, or it has just been a while since we've done it, let me quickly explain how the World Leader Leaderboard works. Over there, behind the rest of the team, you can see we've got a leaderboard of different world leaders' faces from different countries representing most of the world, or certainly a lot of the world. Each week, each panelist gets the opportunity to move one person on the board up and one person on the board down based on who they think has won or lost this week, or who's performed well, who's performed badly. Again, as we always say here, this is in no way an endorsement of any of these politicians, and it is just a week-by-week up-and-down situation. So there might be a situation whereby someone is temporarily too high and needs to be brought down. This is kind of a reflection of live, real-time politics rather than any kind of endorsement. So let's start with the winners of the week. These are people who are going to be moving upwards on the board. Zach, let's start with you. Who is your winner of the week?
Well, my winner, probably not of the week, but since we last did the podcast, is going to be Benjamin Netanyahu. And that is because since we last did the podcast, well, he's going to stay in power. And if you'd asked me, you know, 2 months ago when we did the last World Leader Leaderboard, if Netanyahu would still be in power now, I would have said almost definitely not. He's really not very popular. His approval ratings have been tanking. And polling suggests that his coalition wouldn't really come that close to a majority if an election was held today. But he has been able to hang on by, you know, true to form, very Netanyahu-like his style, just being very stubborn and refusing to go. And if we're being cynical, you know, potentially escalating when the calls for him to resign get too loud.
Yeah.
So, you know, striking an Iranian consulate or something like that. But yeah, so I think from his perspective, you know, he has succeeded in staying in power, and that's a win for him.
Definitely is. He moves off the bottom of the board, the incredibly bad section of the board, up to the just generically bad section of the board. Nadia, up next, who is your winner of the week?
Yes, my winner of the week is Spain's Pedro Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he's kind of set himself out to go on a mission across all the EU countries to try and kind of lobby up his allies to actually support Palestinian statehood. I think it's just, you know, I think it's quite a big thing for, you know, a politician to be just going around and asking, you know, other countries to start like recognizing Palestine as a state.
Mm-hmm.
The EU's like official stance is that they support a two-state solution, and according to Sanchez, it's kind of, you know, if we recognize Palestine as a state, that just kind of reinforces and supports a two-state solution in the long term. So he's kind of being a prominent figure in the EU trying to like actualize their stance on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
he's been nice and ahead of the curve, hasn't he?
Yeah,
because
leading the pack.
Yeah, I think he was calling for the recognition of Palestinian statehood like a month or two after October 7th.
Wow.
I think, yeah, as Nadia just pointed out, like as sort of European opinion has turned, if we're just being frank, away from Israel, he's sort of been a bit of a front runner in that.
Yeah. Sanchez approaching the top of the board, doing pretty well at the moment.
He's also a real survivor. I mean, Pedro Sanchez has tenacity as a politician.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Georgina, who is your winner of the week?
Mine, I'm not sure he's a winner of the week, but he's a very tentative. It's again, he's doing all right, clinging on. But
yeah, we're struggling to find people to go up, weren't we? Because there's so much bad news at the moment.
I know, that's the way news works.
Yeah, it is. It beats it reads. that's allowed.
It's Anthony Albanese. If I didn't say before, and this is because recent state polling from Aston and Dunkley in Victoria, Fadden in Queensland, and a state election in Tasmania, as well as some state by-elections in Queensland and South Australia, and the Brisbane City Council.
So much data.
Wow. So much very local data, local polling, suggests that Albanese will cling on to a second term in office at the next federal election in 2025. And between February and March, his approval rating went up 5 percentage points, even though it's still -7, but you know, I think that's a small win. Yeah.
I think it's very rare that approval ratings go up having gone down. You know, once they go down, the momentum's normally just one way, but that's pretty good. And +5 is pretty good. Also -7 by like Western standards, like Rishi Sunak's what, like -30, Macron's -50, Schultz is -55. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, okay. Fair play Albanese.
Yeah, we like him. He was one of Rory's favorites. You've done a good job replacing Rory on the pod.
Yeah. Doing it for Rory.
Zach.
I say was, the Rory's still alive.
he's just next door.
He's just,
Zach, you obviously moved Netanyahu up just then.
Yeah.
But new addition to the board from you.
Are we doing the new additions now?
Let's do your new addition right now. Who are you adding and what's the connection?
It's a preemptive Benny Gantz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a preemptive Benny Gantz because polling suggests that he will probably be Israel's next prime minister when Netanyahu does eventually go.
And we're putting him in the middle of the board.
Yeah, sure. I think that feels pretty neutral. I mean, maybe up a bit, but he's quite popular in Israel. Let's put him in the middle let's put him in the middle. Okay. As in just like it's easy. But he's pretty popular in Israel. I think he's politically played a pretty good hand because it's always difficult for an opposition politician when a war kicks off. You know, you don't want to be too critical of the government, and he clearly made the right decision to join the National Unity Government, and then sort of like do some tentative criticism from within to distance himself sufficiently from Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think he's played a good hand politically. I think he'll end up being as well as next PM. I think, you know, that this, my intuition is that this should happen quite soon. I mean, the protests against Netanyahu are escalating. Very little suggestion that he'll get the hostages out anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But then again, I would have said that 2 months ago. So maybe we'll be here in a couple of months' time. Benny Gantz will still just be stuck, a sort of lame duck in the middle of the wall. Yeah. And I think Netanyahu's plan really is to try and hold on until November and hope that Trump gets elected, and then maybe the politics will change for him. So we could be waiting that long.
Interesting. Yeah. That is a neither up nor down. It's a pure new addition, which isn't normally allowed. But considering it's been a while, we're letting it slide for each of you. Speaking of which, Nadia, you also have a new addition.
Yes, I do. Another on-brand addition, Alexander Vucic. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm very static today.
So, yeah, obviously,
sorry.
Yeah.
Where are we putting him on the board?
Oh, God. You can put him in the middle. Dead middle.
Okay.
And the reason is because the president, Alexander Vucic of Serbia, he is basically just very good at balancing the East and the West. He's like kind of, you know, wedged himself in the middle of, you know, influence from Russia and China and influence from the EU. And he's kind of just making it work, getting like, you know, the economic benefits from both sides, really.
Mm-hmm.
And something else you wrote
I'm not
about.
Endorsing him at all. This is just, yeah.
I was just going to say something else. You wrote a script for us about this not too long ago. Is that he's also sort of successfully waited out Kosovo.
Yes.
In that originally the EU was, and it's something that still is, quite, well, let's just say more sympathetic to Kosovo than Serbia. But that has sort of changed
Go ahead, yeah.
No, as Kosovo has taken a harder line on certain stuff and sort of strained relations with not just the EU but also the US.
Yeah.
Who have been pretty critical of Kosovo recently. And that's just great for Vucic because he now sort of comes out on top on that.
Yeah.
Nice. Good addition.
He's a very canny statesman, isn't he?
Georgina, who are you adding to the board?
I am adding David Cameron. David Cameron to some.
Last time he was on the board, he wasn't a lord, I think. Or maybe he was.
No, he must have been.
Where are you
purely, I reckon slap him in the middle.
Slap him in the middle.
Purely because he is back.
So he's
back on the board.
What do you mean he's back?
I mean he's a minister again. Okay, even if not prime this time, but foreign.
He's in his prime.
Some might say.
No consensus on that point.
Vote in the comments below.
Is David Cameron in his prime? I think as a politician, he has matured quite well. I think he's doing a pretty good job.
I think he is as well, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's... You could put him on the possibly one above centre, but the reason
I
would as well. I saw... Because just before I came on, I checked, you know, what's going on with Dav Cam, and he's just been in Mar-a-Lago, and he was attempting to convince Trump to support Ukraine and didn't manage... He didn't even get a meeting with Trump.
He just booked a room in the hotel and
he booked a room and they just...
That's so funny.
Oh, and Trump did a video call for Nigel Farage's birthday.
Oh,
that's embarrassing.
Yeah.
So he didn't even get a meeting with him?
No.
So what was that? I saw a little stump speech. Did he just sort of give a speech to no one?
I assume so, yeah.
That's rubbish.
I almost think he should go down now. We'll keep him in the middle.
But I think
next week, better watch out. If he turns up to other people's hotels and doesn't actually get a meeting...
Is he even there?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point. Trump isn't not always there, I guess. He's sometimes in Georgia or something. I don't know.
Oh, that campaign. Is really, but that is quite...
That's pathetic.
Peak on Dav Cam
if he just
didn't even get a... Wow, poor guy. He's all the way to Florida for that.
Can you imagine? Florida, too. Of all places.
I wouldn't mind.
He just wants to stay at a nice hotel. Maybe we could for a video. We could go to Mar-a-Lago. We could see if we could get a meeting with Trump if we just shot to Mar-a-Lago when David couldn't.
It's not the same. It's reminding me of that Four Seasons gaff.
Oh, that is also good. Total landscaping.
Classic, unbelievable.
So good.
The thing I say in Dav Cam's defense, I saw some of the stuff he said in that speech, and he was basically trying to pitch to Republicans, like, this is, from your perspective, good value for money. I'm not endorsing this viewpoint. I think talking about Ukraine in terms of value for money can be a bit like dehumanizing.
Mm.
But he was basically saying that, you know, if you think Russia's strategic like adversary is very good value for money to spend, you know, 0.2% of your GDP kneecapping Russia like militarily in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right way to convince Republicans. You know, I think that that is in some sense canny politicking.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is that Davkam's Davkam, when you said to some he's a lord, and we've gone from to some he's a lord to just Davkam the entire time. I do think that he's a very savvy communicator.
I agree.
And you see those little, yeah, you've seen those Twitter videos of him where he's sort of like walking
single shot through the
He's good, and he's just so I think sometimes you think that like your nostalgia for like 2010s politicians is just nostalgia. But then actually when you actually see them next to a Rishi Sunak, like a 2020s politician, you realise that there's actually just something to it. Like politicians, I think it's fair to say, just sort of were a bit better a couple of decades ago. And like, I think it'd be the same thing with Tony Blair. I often think that people often go like, oh, you only think Tony Blair's better than Keir Starmer because of nostalgia. But actually, if you look at videos of them side by side, it's just not true. Tony Blair just was a better politician. He just was a better communicator. And so
Keir Starmer's at the top of the board, though, and Tony's nowhere, so...
We should get Tony
on it.
Tony on it. But I do think it's interesting in that it just displays so starkly that contrast in, like, competence between today's politicians and those of even a decade ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's fair to say, like, I don't know if it's right to give David Cameron credit for this, but, like, to have not held to his position from 2010 on China, and since he has come out and criticised China for its... kind of aggressive tactics in the South China Sea towards the Philippines, and you know, spoken out about China's surveillance in other countries.
Well, I think there's a couple of really interesting things. I think one, this speaks to the value of having seasoned politicians in ministerial posts. Like the fact that we just cycle through foreign ministers is madness. Like, how can you expect some poor MP who's been representing like a constituency of 30,000 people to all of a sudden know about Gaza and China and Xinjiang and Russia? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And then give them a couple of months in the job and then flip them on to the next one. It's really an advantage to have someone who spent however many decades in politics at the very high international level, representing the UK on the international stage. I think you can already see that. Like, you do, it feels almost like we get a little bit more respect with Davkam about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
not in Mar-a-Lago, though.
No, apparently not. But what was the other thing I was going to say is that, yeah, and I also think that's a symptom of the fact that, in retrospect, it does look like quite a lot of that golden era, the very optimistic take on China that the UK had in the sort of Cameron-Osborne era, I think clearly was an Osborne project. I mean, it was like very much centered around like the commercial advantage to having strong trading links with China, and I think that was Osborne's remit. I also think Cameron had a really interesting Gaza foreign policy. So when he came to power, when he was in opposition, he really criticised Tony Blair. And this is the thing that actually brought Tony Blair down. It's really, really forgotten. Tony Blair supported Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 2006. And this is the thing that slowly brought him down, because like 17 Labour MPs signed a letter telling him that you shouldn't be supporting Israel, which again, just show how much politics has changed in the 15 years, because 17 MPs today would be like, that's par for the course.
And
then it was taken as a resigning matter. Yeah, when Davkam was in opposition, he was criticising the Labour government for their support for Israel there. And then when he got into power in 2010, I think it's mentioned in the video that we're about to release, but his first diplomatic trips were to India and Turkey. And when he was in Turkey, so Erdogan was in power then, as he still is now, obviously. And Erdogan was obviously very, very critical of Israel and sort of like at least a rhetorical supporter of Palestine. David Cameron went on record saying that, describing Gaza as an open-air prison camp. And stuff like that, and he got a furious reaction from obviously, I think it was Netanyahu in power at the time. God, it's weird, isn't it, seeing them all like just
come back again.
They're all back. But yeah, he got a furious reaction, and his policy obviously changed when he came to power. And I think that's just because in some sense, like, that's what prime ministers do. Tony Blair started off more like Israel skeptic and then eventually moved being very pro-Israel. But he moved pro-Israel, but he definitely had some sort of like interest in the topic, and he has clearly has some sensitivity to the Palestinian cause that I think is sort of coming through in the last couple of weeks. You see him, his rhetoric on Palestine has really, really softened, and he's made it very clear to the Israelis that British support is conditional, and that has actually created a bit of a dividing line between him and Sunak. But again, Cameron can do that because he just has the political clout to tow his own path.
Yeah.
And Sunak has no political clout at the moment.
Great.
Sorry, that again,
that's a lot of
rant,
talk for a middle of the board placement.
Just a big Daft Cam fan, apparently.
Apparently so.
He's matured well.
Yeah, again, let us know in the comments. How has he matured? Take that however you want. Let's move back to... Let's go to Nadia, your loser of the week. Who are you moving down on the board?
Yeah, so I think not exactly this week, but like the past month, is Viktor Orban. So
oh, that's a good one.
Got big Orban. Where is he?
He's down one. There you go.
Oh yeah, that's what he looks like. No, sorry. Yeah. So obviously, well, not obviously, but right now there's been like massive protests and demonstrations against Orban, against his government, on a scale really that hasn't been seen in for quite a while. A big reason for this is that is actually two scandals that have kind of like plunged him like twice in a row now in like really short period of time. So in February there was a child sex abuse scandal, and his president and his justice minister both had to resign.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, like around 2 weeks ago, there was a leaked recording of a senior aide who was trying to get involved in a graft case. So that's also like spurred a lot of
a lot of
controversy on, you know, corruption in the justice system. Mm-hmm. Not specifically against Orban himself, but you know, his whole, you know, ministers and whatever.
Yeah.
And the guy that actually leaked the recording was the ex-husband of the former justice minister that got I might be complicating it now, but
it sounds like a soap opera.
It's like a Hungarian soap opera. Yeah. The ex-justice minister that had to step down following the first scandal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Domino scandals.
Crazy. Anyways, and this guy, his name's Peter Magyar. He's basically kind of leading this whole like opposition now against Orban and his government. And he's kind of got this anti-corruption, anti-elitist kind of rhetoric. And so not good for Orban, I think.
No.
Yeah.
Interesting. The momentum on those protests has really picked up. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it sort of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And
it's looking dangerous for him.
Yeah.
Georgina, who are you moving down on the board?
Yes. I'm moving down Kaja Kallas, Prime Minister of Estonia. Actually, through no fault of her own, which feels a bit cruel. But it's a good story, I think. And this is because on April the 1st, an Estonian publication based in London published an article online saying that Kaja Kallas had been confirmed as the next NATO chief, mm-hmm. and made a huge deal of the fact that this was, you know, the first female NATO leader. Mm-hmm. She's the first leader from an Eastern European country. The article went semi-viral and got picked up by major historians like Timothy Garton Ash, if anyone knows him, major British historian of like Eastern and Central Europe. Congratulating Kaja Kallas, and everyone was so excited. And then, no, it was an April Fool's joke. And so Kaja Kallas had to come out and say, no, sorry, guys.
I was going to say it was a mistake.
April Fool's was particularly brutal. I know. And I feel like it's just a bit embarrassing for everyone involved. And the publication came out and said, you know, the reason we wrote this was because we wanted it to generate all this positive attention and show how well-liked Kaja Kallas is and how great that would have been.
That's not how that works.
No, it's just, no. I think, you know, the disappointment generated by the revelation that this was all, in fact, a massive hoax.
That's huge.
Is kind of humiliating and awkward and just...
Oh, poor Kaja Kallas.
She is so popular in the rest of Europe, isn't she? I mean, it's quite amazing.
She is, and that's why I think this was a bit of a shame, like, the way it happened, because...
She's a friend of the channel, isn't she?
She's a friend of the channel. We've met her.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, a couple of times.
Oh.
No. She reminds me almost of, like, I was going to say Estonian Macron... As in, like, she's less popular in her own country than she is outside of it.
I think you're Macron's biggest fan.
I am Macron's biggest
He's
fan.
Only popular outside of the country because you personally outweigh the entirety of France. Who don't you love, though, Zach? Who is your person you're bringing down on the board?
My person going down is Erdogan.
Okay.
Erdogan is going down. The proximate cause is because he lost some local elections. his AKP party rather lost some local elections, which is actually, I mean, astonishingly, it's the first time the AKP haven't won a national election since their founding in like 2003, which is just, I mean, what an that is an amazing record.
That's a good record.
It's unbelievable. I think people sometimes underestimate quite how like formidable a politician Erdogan is. And it's partly that, but then it's also one of the reasons that that didn't work is because of the ongoing economic struggles in Turkey. And so the mainstream narrative on this stuff in Turkey is that Turkey did some funky monetary policy and then switched back to more normal orthodox monetary policy, started like we have in Europe, started raising interest rates and causing a recession in Turkey. And, you know, that is the narrative that's taken hold, and that's been very bad for Erdogan because the economy hasn't turned around. And so he's suffered an embarrassing U-turn and then inflicted a whole lot of pain on the Turkish electorate only for the economy to continue stagnating. One of the things I think that's partly true, but I think there is like, this is not the orthodox take, but it was sort of working for him, his very funky monetary policy before. And so I think he probably would have been as well off, if not better, if he'd just kept interest rates where they were. I mean, I think there were like tentative signs that interest rates were not playing the normal role they do in Turkey. And so like he's completely, if that's true as well, then he's completely shot himself in the foot. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has U-turned in the hope that things would get better, and they just really haven't. He probably, maybe, I think at least, some other people think, he would have been better off sticking with his weird low interest rate policy.
Yeah. Other informed people think.
Yeah, other very well-informed analysts. Yeah. The consensus among well-informed analysts. Yeah. But yeah, so I think Erdogan is going down. I think the other reason is that this is very massive electoral successes for the mayors of Istanbul and Ankara, who are both opposition mayors. And they look very well placed to challenge Erdogan for the presidency if he runs in 2028, which I don't think he's got a lot at this point.
He's got a while to decide.
Yeah.
Finally, as if we haven't broken norms enough with this episode, one more change is, Georgina, you have a full-on removal. Someone who's not only moving down, but is moving off the board, which isn't normally allowed. Normally, this has to be a consensus decision in an overall audit of the board. But in this instance, we're allowing it for your inaugural episode. Who are you removing from the board?
Apologies to him, but it's Geert Wilders.
At least you said his name right.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, it's probably the last time we'll say his name for a while. Poor guy, but he's coming off because he will not be Dutch PM, even though it was thought for a while that he would, because coalition talks collapsed after the centre-right NSC party led by Pieter Omtzigt pulled out of talks, saying that they would not accept him as their prime minister. So in order to get talks going again, he had no choice but to say, okay, I won't then.
I won't be it.
Yeah.
Well, now he's not on the board.
The only tiny caveat I'll put in that is quite interesting about this is that what is Georgina's entirely correct. The most likely outcome is that some new, probably grand coalition is agreed in the Netherlands, or some minority government with some supply and confidence agreement or whatever. But polling suggests that Geert Wilders has just got more and more popular.
Mm.
And so if another election was held today, he got about 25% of the vote last time. He'd probably get more like 35% of the vote this time. So if they can't agree on a new coalition,
get rid of the picture yet.
then Geert Wilders really could make it.
I think if Geert Wilders becomes prime minister and we put him back on the board,
he's
allowed to jump a spot.
God, that's massive for Geert.
Yeah.
Because we took him off and it's a bit like, apologies, Geert.
Yeah.
There you go, back on the board.
Yeah.
Double strength.
I mean, yeah, I think, yeah, otherwise, Georgian is right, he probably will just fade into obscurity. Although he is...
What a promising young man.
Yeah, he's the longest serving MP, do you know that?
Wow.
Yeah, he's been around since like the late 80s or maybe early 90s.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's quite impressive.
That's pretty good. So. Wow. That is the world leader leaderboard as it stands. A real shift towards the middle, I think. It's an unprecedented number of people just dead in the middle of the board. I mean, that obviously is helped by the fact that we added three all to the middle. But we've also had some go up and come down into the middle, of the Albanese and Erdogan both shifting in the opposite direction to where they were already. Interesting as well, the top and bottom, no change at all. There are three absolute chaps at the top of the board, none of them moving. And Rishi Sunak is still avoiding the dead bottom. He was originally one of the founding members of the Total Bottom Club, but now now he's moved up a tiny bit.
That was actually really fun. I think we could do in future, you could definitely do whole episodes of just the world leader leaderboard.
Let us know. Maybe that's the podcast
I'm
now.
Just looking at them, there were so many people, and I'm going to make sure I'm in the mic, so many people that could be moved. I mean, you know, Hamza Yusuf could go down, Millet could go up, Macron could go up to the top.
Spoilers for next week. Okay, that is all for this week. As always, make sure to let us know in the comments who you would move up, who you would move down, where you would place people if you love Macron as much as Zach does. Quick shout out to our friend Dylan on Twitter, who Georgina has been a big fan of watching his movements on the unofficial TLDR leaderboard. Anything particularly notable there, do you think? Or broadly good takes from Dylan?
I think he added quite a few, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do we have
I can't
names?
Remember which.
We should get Dylan on.
Invite Dylan. We don't know where in the world Dylan is. How old is Dylan? Is that his real name? Where's he live? Let's get him in the studio and find out.
I was mainly asking for his political takes, less of his biography, but yeah. Okay,
less exciting. Either way, thanks to Dylan for keeping the board alive on Twitter. And if you want to join him, feel free to make your own leaderboard and submit your own suggestions in the comments and over on Twitter and tag us if you want. That's all for today. We'll be back next week. And goodbye.
Do we wave?
Lovely.
Yay.
Nice work, everyone.
That was good, wasn't it?